Welcome to the Center Church Podcast.
Kate and Jeremy here. Happy Sunday.
My glasses fell off. Are you doing that intro? So I want to make sure. Put got together it. For this.
Got it all together. If I could describe how we look right now.
Matching sweaters.
So we're following up with Ecclesiastes here. Believe it or not, we are almost done. And we're in chapter 10. And there's only so many chapters in this book.
Right. We have a team that's working on writing an additional, a part two to this.
So. And now nobody will ever know. Because nobody's ever read the whole thing.
That's right. That's right.
It's Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 12 through 15 today. We're really stretching it out. I always have this theory that we could do a chapter at a time.
No, I think Brad did. Brad did a whole chapter, I think, at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Which I ended up hearing, and that was, yeah. I mean, he made it happen. 1 week. All of chapter 9. That was back in 2016.
In the early aughts.
Yeah.
Chapter 10, verses 12 through 15. The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city.
So, we remain in this second collection of wisdom teachings where there are these passages that offer at once practical and sometimes other kinds of wisdom about how to navigate the world that we're in. And we find ourselves in verses 12 through 15 where, I know, Kate, in your study, I'm sure it's probably very similar to mine. It seems that much attention is paid to our words and what those words tell us about how we look at others, how we look at ourselves, how we think and look at God. And so what we're going to do as we have conversation around these verses today is we have some initial thoughts and some brief exegesis of verses 12 through 15. Sometimes that's very, very useful, and I think sometimes the text is more easily apprehended. And then we're just going to have some conversation around some observations that I made, and then Kate has some observations as well, so we'll probably just trade those back and forth as we've done in the past. Am I getting that right, aren't I? I think that's the plan.
Sounds good.
So, let's look at just some very quick, brief exegesis here. What I make of verses 12 through 15 is that these are the traits of the foolish person. These are characteristics that are necessary attributes of the fool. So, I mean, on the one hand, like, this could be something that is very much practical wisdom. I mean, it may be very practical to say to someone, you know, okay, it may be good for you to say less than you say. And if they were to follow that, I mean, probably good, all the better for them. So there is this idea that you could say to somebody, okay, you know, a fool multiplies words and you're saying more than is necessary. And they may listen to that and change their habits and change their behaviors. But it seems really that these verses are talking about necessary attributes. So a fool is someone who does these things, and the fool cannot do otherwise. So it's not my kind of first observation here is this is not so much about curbing how much the fool speaks or how malicious the fool is and what he says. Rather, it's about addressing the question: why are they foolish? Because their speech is indicating their foolishness. I don't know. Maybe that's a place to begin. I don't know if you read it as, I don't know if that's fatalistic, but that necessary attribute feature. I don't know if you saw that there as well or not, Kate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the difference between, talking about the difference between the fool and foolishness, I tend to believe there is no identity called fool. The fool spoken of in the Bible so often and the wise is a trope. So we're all capable of foolishness. But this fool being talked about is a cautionary figure who doesn't necessarily actually exist. And I think I'll probably bring this up a little bit again later with more detail, but it's important to mention in the context of the type of literature that we're studying here that a person can behave foolishly and still find one's identity in Christ and not have one's salvation at stake. So I think likewise, one can be wise and still sometimes make choices that don't seem wise. So be careful of the label of fool or wise being, you know, 100% your identity or labeling a person 100%. That similar to what John talked about several weeks ago in terms of like, is it a person or is it a trajectory?
Yeah.
And I think we can talk a little bit more about that later as we dig into it.
Yeah, so the fool in your... By the way, this is that ruined all of the points that I had to follow. But the fool in your idea...
It was a setup.
The fool in your mind then is a... you said a trope. So there's this... So what, these are categories that are empty categories that we don't belong in either of them? Is that kind of what you're saying? I mean...
You know, we can say... What?
Because if that's true, then the wise person may also...
Yes. Necessary attributes of a fool are what you're talking about. And so to say, like, well, is it kind of like a mental health diagnosis or a clinical diagnosis? Okay, here are the three criteria you have to meet to be diagnosed with fool. But if you only meet two, you're not a fool. Or you're, you know, if you look back on your life and you, you know, 49% of your decisions were foolish and 51% were wise... Are you a fool or
right.
are you what, like, or is it like a pass fail thing? Like you're either a fool or not, or you're wise or not. So I think it really gets into this idea of like, you can tear every decision you make apart and your identity and your character apart saying, am I foolish or am I wise? And I think it's fair to say we all can act foolishly. We all can act wise at sometimes. And these cautionary, you know, the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, And some other parts in the Bible, when it's cautioning against being a fool, it's really cautioning against acting in certain ways or helping to guide our decisions and our decision making, because you don't want to be the fool. But I don't know that character, it's kind of a caricature. Just like a lot of the Proverbs are like broad generalizations, but there's exceptions to all of them. Like, you know, for example, raise up your children in, you know, in the way and they won't stray from it or they'll come back or whatever. Well, we all know that doesn't always happen that way. Really great people can raise their children in really great ways. And then their kids still don't turn out the way that they thought they would. Is it because they didn't follow that proverb correctly? Like,
yeah,
it's pretty vague in general. And so like there's these generalizations.
Yeah, the nature of wisdom
yeah.
teaching themselves.
Yeah, the nature
yeah.
of wisdom teaching themselves would say, well, like the fool does this and the wise does this. And it's just basically saying like, guidance on behavior, but not really saying like you will end up a fool or you will.
Yeah,
end
I mean,
up
I mean,
wise.
I don't know anybody that. Yeah, you. I mean, we would all admit that we've acted foolishly, and we know people that would certainly say, "Okay, yeah, I acted foolishly." I don't really know anybody that self-identifies in the category of being a fool. On the other hand,
nobody would
right?
They?
Nobody. Or, but I guess what I'm saying is, you can almost fill in what you want into that category. On the other hand, I mean, people all the time are aware, okay, well, I said this thing,
mm-hmm.
and it was self-destructive in some way because, you know, I said a thing, and it had these consequences, and I'm aware, there's this concrete awareness of the words that I used, or this act that I, this thing that I did had these consequences that were unhelpful at best. And so essentially, you know, decision to decision, we're able to kind of identify wisdom and foolishness, but it's as a broader category, I mean, people don't really put themselves in the category of the fool.
Yes. And perhaps.
Or maybe they do. I just don't know.
Some may, you know, some people out of humility.
Or looking back, you know, like,
yes.
And
we can definitely look back and say, well, that decision I made was foolish or something like that. But at the same time, I think to even recognize foolishness in one's own life and perhaps even other people's lives, but mostly in your own life, requires a certain amount of self-awareness that I don't even know is available to this character of fool that we're seeing.
Right. Yeah, and that I definitely agree with. I've thought about that a lot as we've been in these conversations around the last few chapters of Ecclesiastes, which is, I mean, if you are the fool, I don't know that you would know that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, right? I mean,
once you are wise enough to be able to see that your behavior was foolish, are you then no longer a fool? So I think that's maybe it's getting into some real semantics there of, am I acting foolishly or am I a fool? Like, are you a thing or do you act a thing?
Well, we know that whatever you would say about that kind of question and maybe problem, we know that the behaviors of the fool, as it's represented in this trope, which again, I'm glad you pointed out that it's common across wisdom teaching, it certainly is. It's not even so much about, again, and now this is me reading into the text, but as far as I can tell, it's not so much about avoiding these behaviors or even curbing them. Again, all the better if you do, because I think that happens, but the more interesting problem or question is, what is it about me that is causing these behaviors mm-hmm. to manifest?
I think that's the most helpful way to look at it, because once you recognize it's, you know, it's practical advice, it's practical general advice, then how do you begin to apply that? I think that's the important thing, to not stop at, I'm sure glad I'm not the fool.
Yeah, I don't really know where our culture is on things like, I don't know how much attention, say, let's take something like self-helpism, you know, like that kind of, or popular self-help books or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't really know how much attention or energy has been given to the management of, okay, so here's how you don't say the wrong thing at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. I'm not really even doubting that. That's probably useful at times, but I don't really quite know where our culture is on this, but it seems that the author of Ecclesiastes, that Colette is speaking past that. If these things are happening, you are behaving in a foolish way, or you're within this trope, or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. That look at the fruit.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. So Luke. I wanted to bring this passage up, because, and I think this is probably as good a time as any. Luke chapter 6, verse 45. I think that's a very famous passage. The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good. So this is what you're saying about the fruit, I think. The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good. And the evil person, out of the evil treasure, produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. So this is really, this is why we can spend some time on only three or four verses. I'm very, very interested in what it is to understand our hearts so that we can identify why certain things are coming out of them. And I'm sure that, could speak for myself, I'm sure it's true for all of us, that we've been in situations where, like, why would I think that, say that? That doesn't seem like me. And I don't know that it's, you know, without analyzing too deeply every word that's ever uttered, you find yourself sometimes the posture of some of these very negative attributes. And I think that demands that we scrutinize our heart. So maybe a little bit of exegesis to kind of walk through some of this. The language we use can reveal some of the unwellness that is in our hearts. It can reveal it to us. And I think that what we have here is this impetus to scrutinize the heart, because out of the heart the mouth speaks. So verse 12 is largely about self-destructive language, right? So I'm going to, and this is something I prepared for this discussion, a few questions you might consider as you're thinking through these passages, and treat these as an opportunity to analyze what you don't want to be, right? The behaviors you do not want to engage. So verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. So this is clearly self-destructive behavior, right? So when do you find yourself saying things, true or otherwise, that you know will only have negative consequences for you?
This kind of goes back to chapter 4, verse 5, talking about the fool locks his hands together and eats his flesh. So by your own words, it's self-cannibalism. It's such a vivid imagery. And really hits home, I think.
I think it does, because I think everybody knows that moment when they're saying, this is not beneficial for me to say. Is it so important for me to say this, to engage this, that I'm willing to experience the destructive consequences of it? And the answer for some people actually quite often is yes. So loud is our heart that we're willing to cost ourselves something to utter some words. And I'm much less interested in, I don't know, the strategies to avoid saying those words, even though, I think that falls into some kind of practical wisdom, than asking the question, like, why are we so compelled to say certain things?
Yeah.
Where is that coming from? And I think that demands a level of scrutiny guided by community, guided by the scriptures, guided by the Spirit of God in us. So
it's so similar to the difference between, you know, when you're trying to break a habit, snapping a rubber band on your wrist every time you want to do it, over figuring out why it is that you even need to engage in the behavior. You know, you can punish yourself and like you would with an animal, like teach them, like, hey, when you do that, it hurts. And yeah, that's basically what this is saying. When you do that, it hurts. But I like that your point is that's not where it ends. Like, it hurts, and so figure out why you're doing it to begin with. Like, where is that bitterness, anger, judgment, whatever it is that's, like, spilling up like a fountain out of your heart, where is that coming from?
Right. Let's look at verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. So we're looking at malicious language here. Maliciousness. This question, we encourage you to, as in trying to find silver linings and not being able to be with one another every Sunday like we would prefer, but you know, take the time to listen to these questions again and genuinely give yourself time during the week to meditate on these. I think you'll find that it'll reveal things about who you are. Reveal things about your heart that can be restored. Here's a question on maliciousness. When do you notice in yourself an eagerness to speak negatively about others? This is more, by the way, than mere gossip. Gossip is quite destructive, but it's more than that. I think even a better question really is why is this satisfying to you? What is its effect on your heart, on your inner being, on your kind of that seat of wisdom that is the seat of understanding that is referred to when you think about the heart? Why is it that, what do we get out of maliciousness in language about speaking negatively about other people? I mean, what does that actually do for us? And I think that if we find that that's a part of our lives, if it's something our heart wants, I think we should scrutinize that. Verse 14, and then we'll move into some analysis of these passages. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? We always try to credit the commentaries that inform our discussions and our teachings. And we'll certainly do that here. But one scholar really identified this as deceptiveness. And I found that very, very interesting. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, which seems kind of like what exactly is the connection there? I don't think it's entirely self-evident, or actually there might be many connections there, maybe another way of thinking of it. But here are some questions that I would like you to consider as it pertains to verse 14. Where do you find you most often use the abundance of language to tell yourself or others a narrative that you know does not comport with reality? So this is, I think we're all very familiar with this, which is the more you say it, kind of, I'm going to keep speaking it. I'm going to keep saying it over and over and over, and maybe it'll drown out. It doesn't become more true the more you say whatever it is. It doesn't become more true the more you say it, but maybe you can, maybe for a second you can, you can drown out. You can what? Cancel, attempt to cancel out like those deeper truths about how reality actually is. And so this idea of multiplying words to deceive ourselves and others about the reality that we're actually in, I think that's very familiar to all of us. And so, and seeing these negative frames of what the fool is, or the traits or attributes of the fool, I think it's at once a call to scrutinize our hearts and understand why our language is motivated at times in these negative directions. I don't know. I think that I'm kid. I don't know if you. I'd be interested to know what insight you have on this. But I think it's. I'm always interested in the ways in which church is reduced to behavior management, when the fact that we are forgiven and free and loved in Christ means that that's exactly the thing that we can not spend endless energy, spend all this energy on. And in fact, we can really begin to ask the question, okay, so yeah, I know I need to, I should gossip less or something like this, or gosh, I use a lot of malicious language. Well, now we can observe what heart conditions are bringing us to that place. And so I think that we need to spend some real time with these questions.
I think part of the issue becomes when we talk about heart change, most of us know that heart change is the objective, that it's more than just our behavior, but our measure of whether or not our heart has changed is our behavior. And so we get caught up in this idea that, well, if my heart has changed, my behavior will reflect it. So if my behavior is not reflecting it to the level that I think it should, or other people think it should, then we begin to become so behavior focused. And one of the measures is what fruit is bearing in your life. And so if, you know, it's a dead branch, it gets cut off. Okay, that's true. But it's important to note that to look at the holistic picture of what we would call your behavior or your fruit. And again, coming back to that self-awareness piece as well, like if we are self-aware enough to be able to start judging our behavior as, or our hearts has changed or not, then I think these questions are really helpful if we're willing to be honest with ourselves and not fall into that trap of what you were saying earlier. The more you say it, the more true it becomes. And this idea that you're trying to convince yourselves and others that your reality is different than what it really is.
Okay, so I think those are some useful, maybe initial bits of commentary or insight on these verses. There's actually quite a bit to unpack there, and I hope that genuinely that you take the time to do that. We'll look at a few. We have a few points, and typical in the way we've done this thus far, I don't know all that Kate really has to say about this. I don't think she knows all that I really have to say about it, but I'll offer an observation, and she'll have some observations as well, and we'll kind of interact over those. And I'd like to talk about really two things. The first is the language that we use toward one another, and I'll talk about that, and we'll talk about that, and then after that, the language we use as we think about really ourselves, toward ourselves. So the first point I have, those of you who are, you know, keep track, always ground your heart in transcendent truth. So this is about the language that we use toward one another, and I would encourage you to always ground your heart in transcendent truth. So verse 14, about the fool that multiplies his words, though no man knows what is to be. There's some really, I think, important insights to gain from verse 14 if we spend some time with it. And first, by the way, it's true that Kate and I really didn't touch on this exactly, but it's worth noting. Some people use a lot of words to drown out the things that they don't want to face in their lives, but there are many who use multitudinous words, right, to drown out positive things as well. So this is not even so much about avoiding the negative and embracing the positive. In fact, it's not that at all. It's about being connected to reality and not allowing words to reform, and not attempting to allow language to reform the reality around us. So I think in this way we have a reference to the very enigmatic Ecclesiastes chapter 11, and we'll get there. This is chapter 11, verse 1. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. I don't really see that hanging in many homes.
I'm embroidering it right now.
Other than our own, yeah. So there's a cross stitch for you. So if your contribution to the world you are in is malicious, if it's deceptive, if it's self-destructive language, yeah, you're going to begin to see the poisonous fruits of not only in what you're seeing in other people, but also in what you're seeing in yourself. So there is something very reciprocal about this. If this is the sort of thing you're putting into the world, yeah, it's going to become a frame for how you look at the world, and that includes how you look at yourself. Or Ecclesiastes 11 is just about maritime commerce. It's one or the other. So I think that there's something about this verse 14, that certainly applies there. But I think it's actually more interesting even than that. Verse 12, the lips of a fool consume him. Okay, he was talking about that kind of really stark imagery of cannibalism. Verse 13, his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil and madness. This is what I mean about grounding your heart in transcendent truth. So please follow me on through this line of thinking. It's entirely reasonable, if you're reading these passages and thinking sincerely about them, to say, yes, but that the words that I said about my employer are true, or the things that I'm saying about that acquaintance is true. The things I'm saying about this friendship that went sideways are true. The things that I'm saying about this family member are true. Maybe you're right that person or that situation is the things that you say it is. By the way, often we badly misread situations and we cast them in our own light. So let's say for argument, though, that your insights, your observations about the person, the situation, that whatever, let's say that they are correct. I would like to posit that even if they are in very real ways true, wisdom means we must subordinate these things, which are so temporal anyway, to deeper and lasting truths about how God has made us to look at one another. So this is really what I'm talking about when I say that we should always ground our hearts in transcendent truth. Because, in fact, even when we are observing things about reality that would want us to engage in malicious language or self-destructive language, the most true things about reality have to do with redemption, have to do with the love of the other that is so transformative that it entirely empties the category of other. There we get rid of the category itself. So deep is the and profound is the love of Christ. And those truths, those transcendent truths, are the things that I think really feed our heart and really establish us as wise Christ followers. I think it's also they're very elusive. What I mean by elusive is to go back to a message we had a few weeks ago, it takes a certain kind of acuity, a focus to really live in that place. I think it's also worth saying, and Kate and I were talking about this prior, I mean, it's also the case that the ways we think and feel about people are ultimately incredibly changeable. I mean, they are the idea that, you know, as we think about the language that we use toward other people and what that really says about our heart condition, the idea that, well, you know, the thing I'm saying is it's true. Yeah, that's as if that's the highest bar. I mean, it's true in this moment, but in another moment, the circumstance has already changed. In a year, the individual that is of utmost concern to you, that is the object of your ire or disdain, that individual will be a very different person. And give it a few more years, they'll be a radically different person. You change, circumstances shift and change, and they put people and their actions in entirely new lights. And so I think we have to just be incredibly humble about our own grasp of people and circumstances, and rather I think we should place our trust and our grounding in transcendent truth instead.
So to summarize, the fool talks a lot about subjects he knows nothing about. And it's clear from all we studied in this book so far, good fortune and bad fortune occur in the lives of the wise and the foolish in ways that are unpredictable to us most of the time. So last week, you talked about misfortune befalling honest workers by no obvious error that they've made. The fool talks of the future in terms of worry about it. That's what we often hear. It's foolish to worry about the future. And anxiety about the future is futile. But I would also say that predicting the good things of the future represents foolishness as well. And hope is never foolish. So we have assurance of the resurrection. We aren't predicting or speculating on this. So the hope that we have in Christ is solid and not in doubt.
But you do know when it's going to happen.
Yes, and you only have to buy my ebook for $5.99, download the PDF to find out the numerology code.
Right.
So the hope we have in Christ is solid and not in doubt. And looking forward to this with anticipation is not foolish. So I'm not talking about hope. I'm talking about in the same way we all accept that the fool speculates about the unknowable future in terms of anxiety, they may also boast about the unknowable future in terms of what they will accomplish or gain. So James chapter 4, verse 13 says, "Now listen, you who say, 'Today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money,' why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes." So it reads like disdain for boasting about what life will look like tomorrow. And so then you might be thinking, well, are we not even supposed to dream about the future then? Can we even help it? It seems like dreaming about the future is something intrinsic to being human. It is one of the things that makes us human. So perhaps it's not that we shouldn't, but that we just have to frame it correctly for it to even make sense. James continues in verse 15. "Instead, you ought to say, 'If it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that.'" So rather than a boast or a prediction of the future that is not certain, dreaming about the future and making plans for tomorrow is a statement of hope. This is our plan. This is what we hope the outcome will be, but we recognize God is sovereign and even the best laid schemes of mice and men go off in askew. I definitely don't expect the entire church to begin amending their conversations with us with, if it's the Lord's will. It's definitely understood. We get it.
Michael Trask already does that.
He does. When he's shining the buckles on his shoes.
That's
and putting
right.
on his Puritan hat.
That's it.
I think we forget sometimes and even get into the boasting category. So this verse is just a good reminder of what it means to cross the line from normal person to fool. That hope is good. Hope is wise, in fact, when it is a hope in the resurrection and in the promises that God has for us. But when we extend that boasting to predicting what our temporal lives will be like tomorrow, that's when I think we kind of cross the line into foolishness.
Yeah, I think that it's very, very interesting. And it's in a way very different than what I, mm-hmm. than the observation I had from the text. But I don't think it's a stretch to say that as far as I can tell, I think maybe humility is a thread that connects both of our kind of observations on these verses thus far, which is to say, my interest was observing kind of a humility that insists that we not make our present reality or our present circumstance the defining way we look at people and ourselves, and therefore sign language that perhaps we shouldn't. Humility insists that transcendent truth trumps the reality in front of us. And I think what you're saying is that hope, the right hope in there is hoping in the correct things and letting go of kind of the wish fulfillment that can really so easily seep into like our everyday life is another form of, I also see that as kind of an act of humility, giving up. And again, I'm always reluctant to, I think, passages that are just quoted so often that are so popular and therefore seem, oh yeah, yeah, I've heard that, I know it.
We just need to throw those out, right?
Right, yeah. The challenge is not that, I mean, they're well known, but the issue is that they're very hard to apprehend as a part of our lives. It is very easy, and not talking about the hope that you're referring to, which is actually beautiful and deep, but also in a sense narrow, right? Like it's the most wonderful thing you could hope for, but also it says nothing about your career success, and it says nothing about if you'll enjoy the vacation or not, and it says nothing about if, you know, the relationship will work out or won't. And I think that those kinds of, I think there, it requires a humility about both the present and the future to begin to work very hard at letting go of those things, because most of us are future-oriented, I think, in a way, I don't know if this is true, as far as I can tell, I think it's true that most of us are future-oriented in a way that is not productive. It's not really quite what you're talking about. We really are thinking about the next thing, right? And that is, I think, very destructive to being able to meditate and dwell on what is present right before us. So,
only the penitent man will pass.
Only the penitent man will pass. Shall we look at the second point?
Yes.
The language we use toward ourselves is the second and final observation I have on these passages. The first observation, language we use toward one another, always ground your heart in transcendent truth. Second observation, the language we use toward ourselves, know the way to the city. And so it's interesting, we talked about this very early in the series in Ecclesiastes, the Edenic references. It's incredible. It's rich with, I mean, as the Bible is anyway, but like particularly in Ecclesiastes, the richness of the Genesis 1 and 2 passages, the creation passages, even some of the fall passages that we see. And we see that the humanness, it's really, you know, I couldn't help but think about this as we were reading about language and how talk can lead us to evil and lead us to madness. You have this unique character in the garden And you're asking, I mean, we have to ask, made unique by what? And we could talk about that extensively. And at minimum, we know that the serpent is also crafting language as a weapon. That you have Adam and Eve and the serpent who are all essentially probing and examining what is and isn't true, and then in the case of the serpent cleverly recasting reality for Adam and Eve, right? So there's this interesting feature of how language is used even at the very beginning of the biblical account, and the intuition to bend truth with language to our own will. So this takes us to, I think, a very interesting verse, verse 15, which we've not touched on yet. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. So the fool is unable to accomplish what he wants to do, and he never makes it to the city. And as far as I can tell, I mean, it seems to attribute that inability, that ineffectualness, to the fact that he's multiplying words, the maliciousness, the self-destructiveness. The fool is not able to accomplish the goals that are set in front of him. And whether we choose to think about this city as literal, figurative, both, I think it's good to think about it, in fact, as symbolic as well as something that is literal, something that is practical wisdom, as well as something that's like perhaps much deeper. Whether we choose to think about the city in any of these ways, a mouth and a heart that is obsessed with these things, these negative things, a heart that is spewing these kinds of things, is one that will run out. It will, in fact, run you to death. You will simply wear out. And what's so interesting to me about this is, you know, we can spend time, and we've all, I think, been in situations and known people where the amount of energy that is spent, splitting hairs, like who said what and when and what way and what time. I mean, look, even if you come out of some of these things and you're proven to be right, the reality that you're looking at, your interpretation is maybe the correct one. The idea here is that for the fact that you're focused on these things, the fact that the mouth is presenting what is in the heart is absorbed with these things, the outcome of that is that the work that really matters, the destination that really matters, knowing the way, will be lost to you. You simply will not have the follow through because all of the energy has been poured into the wrong things, has been aimed at the wrong things.
One of the best things about Colette is the amount of fool bashing that he engages in. So, it's so good. It's almost like when you're watching a roast and it's like they each take turns, like, one-upping each other. And he's like, the fool doesn't even know how to get back to the city. And it seems like he just really laid this down. And modern readers are like, what? Because it's like, it's an idiom, but the exact meaning of it is not quite known to us. So we're all kind of just like, well, it probably means this. So the context suggests that it's an illustration of how stupid the fool is. Some action that publicly demonstrates his foolishness, so he doesn't know to return to the city. Like, he's so stupid, he doesn't even know.
Oh, something that everybody knows.
Yeah, like, of course you go home at the end of the night, but here's the fool, not going home. He doesn't have the good sense. He wanders aimlessly because he knows no better.
That makes sense of the toil, anyway.
Yeah, or the toil is so wearisome to him because he has lost the city. So, like, the whole day's work is made even worse because he can't even, like, he's just trying to get home and he can't. He's just like out in the middle of nowhere. Who knows where the fool is? And so the day's work becomes an even more arduous task. I remember when I was going to college down in Arkansas, and Jeremy was in southern Missouri, and we were dating long distance, and I would drive back and forth. And this was the days before GPS. I didn't even have, like, those little TomTom machines. I would just have these paper maps. And I would get turned around in the dark or take a wrong turn and add, like, 2 or 3 hours onto a trip that should have been just, like, straightforward. So, like, I am fool. This is me. Something that should have been straightforward and easy. There is like a documentation of an Egyptian phrase, which is does not reach the city, which means to fail in attaining a goal. So the fool's toil wearies him because he's unable to accomplish what he sets out to do, which is kind of what...
Closer to yours.
Yeah, that's Fox stating this. Fox states that the verse may have originally appeared with verse 3 of chapter 10. So... the combined reading would have been, even when he's just walking along the road, the fool reveals to everyone that he is stupid, for he wearies himself by getting lost on the way to town. So he's like, gets lost on the way to the best known place. Like, how can you miss it, sort of thing. So Colette hates the idea of working and then having nothing to show for it. Like, he really seems to despise this idea of the fool working hard and then having no result. Not necessarily a money result or in wealth. He means any human deed or output that's meant to achieve something for oneself or for creation or for one's legacy.
Yeah, there's something attractive about the absurd, because so often Colette seems to operate in that place, commenting on other wisdom literature, particularly Proverbs, say, but then like sometimes these absurd images, right? And so there's something incredibly absurd and ridiculous about the fool not knowing his way home,
right.
The fool bumbling through the city again today. And so there's something about that image that it kind of resonates, really. And I think it is also, useful, I think, at a, through like kind of a cultural analysis. We all would rather be, I've said this before, but, if you have to choose between being, say, naive or cynical, everybody chooses cynical. I mean, you don't want to be cynical. It's vacuous. But you certainly don't want to be naive. And there's something that I think at a cultural level, sometimes we give kind of props to malicious language, or we kind of laud certain language or words that really are more self-destructive than beneficial, and you get this image, actually, and here this is counter image. Actually, no, that language leads to you wandering around, like an idiot, in the middle of a city. As however clever or smart it seems right now, actually, the deeper wisdom is ultimately that you're the fool.
Yes.
I'm probably interjecting too much.
No,
but I think that...
it's good. It's what are you accomplishing with your life? If all you have to rack up is some like cynical burns, like that's, you're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. So what are you even doing if that's what you're doing? Think about it. John and Brad discussed a few weeks ago when the three of you recorded the podcast, this idea of foolishness as a state of being or as a trajectory. And I kind of brought this up earlier. So I wonder, do we know we were, like, when we look back on our lives at the end and see a life lived in unceasing, ineffectual toil, do we recognize that as foolishness? And this being more cautionary tales, perhaps one cannot be a fool or wise. A person can guide their actions and decisions based on these vivid examples of the wise juxtaposed with the fool. Kind of like Dwight Schrute from The Office when he says, Whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do not do that thing. And that's how you read Ecclesiastes.
Do not do that thing. So to summarize our points, the language we use toward others becomes the language we use on ourselves. And it goes the other way also. The language we use, the language we direct toward ourselves, can often become the language we use toward other people. And these things that come out of our mouth, the words that we use, reveal our hearts. And I think all of us need to value one another and ourselves rightly, and that means scrutinizing our hearts. If you're in this place in one way or another, and again, I would encourage you to go back to the questions that we opened with. If you're in this place, what shall we do? I would encourage you to begin with prayer. Colossians 4:2 says this: continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. This so directly connects to Kate's commentary on hope, the right kind of hope. When we talk about hope, it doesn't mean that everything works out exactly as you would like. It's trust. It's trust in Christ at work now and fully. And Colossians 4:2, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. This passage, this watchfulness, is about us looking at ourselves and one another, first and foremost, as Christ looks at us. If you're in that place, if you're in this place of dark language that reflects an unhealthy heart, begin with prayer, seeing God open to you the son or daughter he has made you to be. That is, by the way, a form of worship, to see that God is in fact restoring us and putting the world back together. So big is the character of this person, and that's you, by the way. So deep is your value to God that you'll find less and less room for the things that exhaust you, or drive you to distress, or keep you from the city, whatever that means. In verse 14 of Ecclesiastes, Colette says, "No man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him?" You know, the thing that is to be, in fact, will be better than you, or Colette for that matter, ever could have dreamed or hoped, because that is realized in the full person of Jesus. We'll end with 1 Corinthians 2, verse 10, and then Kate will close us in prayer. "For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For who knows a person's thoughts except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual person judges all things, but is himself to be judged by no one. For who has understood the mind of the Lord, so as to instruct him. But we have the mind of Christ. It is not wrong. It is not self-indulgent to understand that you carry the Spirit of God and that you have the mind of Christ. Those are the words that you need to speak. First receive. Those are the words that you need to first receive. And those are the truths that you need to share with others. These truths that transcend our situations and transcend our understanding.
Join me in prayer. Lord, help us to place our hope in you and only in you. Guide us in the path of wisdom. Make our lives fruitful to your purpose. Help us to identify ways in which we are thinking or speaking maliciously. Help us to identify when our words lead us to eating ourselves alive. Identify the areas in our lives where we are deceiving ourselves and others. Lord, be our guide and our help and our portion in this week and in the weeks to come.